Sego, I'm John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. I want to thank you for joining me. We are broadcasting in New York City and in Washington, D.C., and as such, I've got to do the lifting, folks. We are listener-supported radio, and we depend on your contributions to both WBAI and WPFW. We rely on those dollars. They are essentially our sole source of income for these stations to keep us on the air. And I got to tell you, it's not always easy. We're still recovering post-COVID. We're, you know, people are still not back in what you consider their normal spaces. And as a result, WBAI in particular is really at a tipping point. So we have, not only do we have the pledge lines, and I'll give them both to you, but we also accept one-time contributions, and we encourage sustaining members. On WBAI, we call those sustaining members BAI buddies. And, you know, I used to have quite a few of them. Over time, some of those I've lost. And I picked up, I think, at least a couple over the last few weeks. But I need more. You know, and every show is really pushing this campaign to have more sustainable members join these two radio stations in the name of the program, that you're currently listening to. So I'm asking, if you're listening in New York City or anywhere, if you're listening online, the show goes up as a podcast. We are Facebook live streaming at the same time. Wherever you're listening, I hope that you'll support WBAI and WPFW. If you want to make a contribution to WBAI, I ask that you pick up the phone and you call 212-209-2950 or go online to give2wbai.org and make whatever contribution you can. Look, if you can do a one-time contribution now or maybe some other time in the future, that's great. But if you can do 5, 10, or 20, or perhaps even more as a sustaining member, as a BAI buddy, or as a sustaining member of WPFW, this gives us money that we know is coming in that we can budget and work into our cash flow, into our operating expenses. So again, in New York City, that's 212-209-2950 or give2wbai.org. If you are contributing to WPFW in Washington, D.C., which I hope that you will, it's 202-588-9739. Or go online to wpfwfm.org/donate. You can follow the tabs to do a one-time donation, become a WBAI buddy or sustaining member, and support not only the station, but support my space on these stations. Because, look, both WPFW and WBAI have to have a reason to carve out this 1 hour for me. And you know, if you've listened over the years, I've gone from different time slots. I was a two-hour show for a while. I used to do almost exclusively talkback and call-in radio. Now I still try to present a topic, go to the phones when I can, and we're getting more into that, especially as we've gotten more comfortable with our with the technology we use today to do the show remotely. For those that don't know, I'm not in New York. I'm not in Washington. I'm on the Cattaraugus territory of the Seneca Nation. I do this show each week from my own studio here in Seneca territory. And, I hope to get on the road. As a matter of fact, speaking of getting on the road, I'm going to be down in Mount Vernon this Saturday for an event. And we're talking about colonization. And we're talking about colonization from Mount Vernon to Gaza. So we're going to be talking about the effects of all that stuff. So if you're available, if you're in the New York area and you want to take a short train ride up to Mount Vernon and join us. I think we're at the Mount Vernon Library. You can check my Facebook pages. I've got it posted up, and you can see more information on that. Or inquire in general. You can find more information about this event. And that's Saturday from from 1 to 3 o'clock, I believe. So look, and this is part of my commitment. I want to start getting back into the community. Look, I've been settling in back home. Doing this show remotely, and look, I want to stretch my legs. I want to get out there. I want to meet some people face to face. So that's what we're looking forward to. All right. So here's what I've got for today. And I will go to the calls later on in the program. But I've mentioned earlier on previous programs that one issue that I'm going to pound throughout this year is the fact that we are in this year is essentially the 100th anniversary of what was called the Indian Citizenship Act. So I really feel like I've got to explain what that is. And I've got to talk about what's happened in the 100 years since that congressional act and exactly what that congressional act was. But I also have to talk about what happened to during the preceding, prior to that declaration that we are U.S. citizens. I think people have to have a right to know what that was all about. Because while if you ask, look, if you go online and say, when did Native people become U.S. citizens? It's always going to say 1924. They're always going to refer to the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. It was a piece of legislation that was put forward by a New York congressman. And it was really geared towards the United States trying to settle what had been this longstanding debate about what is the status of Native people. So in 1924, in fact, June will be the anniversary of when it was signed into law by Calvin Coolidge. It isn't a pathway to citizenship. It is a declaration. It is simply a declaration by the Senate and the House, almost a joint resolution. But no, this is a law where they voted and declared that Native people were U.S. citizens. They didn't ask us. This isn't, okay, you can be one if you want to be. No, it wasn't that. There were previous laws that were ran along those lines. But this one was just like, no, we're imposing this on you. We are making you a U.S. citizen. And essentially, what they're trying to suggest is that our identities no longer would be sustained or recognized. I mean, because look, here's what happens. I've heard Native people say, and others say, well, isn't that when the United States allowed dual citizenship for Native people? No, it wasn't. Because the United States would not recognize. In fact, there's previous laws, and I'll talk about those, where they flat out said, no, you're not distinct people. You are no longer a distinct sovereign nation. We are placing you initially as wards of the state. And in this situation, and in fact, in some of the previous laws that were geared towards Native people becoming U.S. citizens, they made the Native people disavow any tribal affiliation, dissolve who they were. So when I hear people say, well, yeah, 1924, the United States allowed us to be dual citizens. No, they didn't. Now, they will acknowledge that we can call ourselves enrolled members of a nation or a tribe. But that's not recognizing us as citizens of the Mohawk Nation or the Seneca Nation or the Choctaw Nation or the Oglala. None of that stuff. No. That's like, okay, yeah, that's, you know, something you can put bumper stickers on your car over. So I want to talk about this. I think it's important that people understand what that relationship was and what that status means. Because here's the other thing. They may have passed this law and declared that we were U.S. citizens in 1924, but Native people weren't exactly allowed to vote until, in fact, in Maine, it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 or whatever else that was passed. That's when Native people in Maine could finally vote. They were the last state in the nation to allow Native people to vote in elections. Because, again, keep in mind, in case you didn't know, the states are the ones that run these elections. Not just state elections, they run national elections. So state by state, they could say, no, we're not allowing Native people to vote. And that's what happened. I mean, so this gets passed in 1924, but then you get to a 1948 when the Arizona State Supreme Court threw out a law that prohibited Native people from voting. And that's, you know, 24 years after we were so-called, you know, declared citizens. And then it wouldn't be until 1965 in the Voting Rights Act where the final states in the United States were forced to allow Native people to vote if we wanted to. Now, but therein lies part of the problem. When they declared us U.S. citizens, did that make us U.S. citizens? Do we have to accept that? So was it so much of an imposition that we were left with no choice? I argue that that's not the case. In fact, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not a U.S. citizen. I reject that law and any imposition of the United States to make me a U.S. citizen. I'm Mohawk. I'm Gunyagahaga. I'm Ungwe. That's what I am. I am not subjected or subjugated. I have not been, you know, placed under the United States, not as a ward, not as a citizen. So, you know, I don't, sometimes I don't know whether I should go forward from 1924 or if I should go backwards. So I'll tell you what, we'll go forward first. So like I said, it's not like Native people could turn around and vote. When they passed this law, there were a couple of issues that had, especially in New York, that had risen up in the from a state level. And it was this question about, well, who has obligations that were made to Native people? I mean, there were like payments, I mean, associated with treaties and that kind of stuff. The state was making those payments for a while. And the state says, wait a second, we're not supposed to be making these payments. The federal government's supposed to. Then there were issues associated with education and health care, because along with these massive cessions of land was a trade-off. We were supposed to get paid, and we were supposed to be guaranteed health, education, and welfare. And so that didn't happen, not from the federal government. In fact, today, it is still, for the most part, states that are providing the education, states that are providing through the Medicare and Medicaid, healthcare. Yes, the Indian Health Services throws some money, and there are some federal funds that come into to states to offset a school district that has Native people there. But that, frankly, that has more to do with the fact that we don't pay property tax. So the states were not ever lifted of the burden that the federal government was supposed to have taken on with a lot of these so-called treaties and land cessions. Now, look, don't get me wrong. New York holds title to the land that we don't hold title to, not necessarily the federal government. There are federal lands, but so New York was the beneficiary of these cessions. So I'm not trying to let New York off the hook. But this is what a lot of people don't understand. So when they did this in 1924, would that make us taxable? Did it make us required to register for the draft? Well, I'll tell you, that's some of what happened. In the 1940s, when they started whenever they had the draft registration, especially in the run-up to World War II, Native people started getting draft notices. We said, hey, you can't send us draft notices. We're not yours. And they said, well, yeah, we passed the law back in 1924. Well, nobody told us. Nobody asked us. And, of course, there's other issues, like the U.S. Census. Look, in the United States Constitution, Native people are mentioned three times. The first time we're mentioned is in what they call the Apportionment Clause of the Constitution. And there they say, we are not to be counted. We are not to be enumerated for taxation, for representation in Congress, and frankly, for the census. I mean, the census was this, you know, again, if you don't know, every 10 years, they're supposed to count everybody that lives here. Well, there is a debate on how much we were counted. So there's never any real accurate numbers on how many Native people there were at any given time, because we may or may not have participated in that census. And oftentimes we see the census records and we know, look at that name they just made up. Or that guy's listed twice because they caught the same guy in two different locations to ask him his name. He didn't necessarily give the same name twice. So I mean, this is, you know, the confusion that exists. And frankly, some of the controversy that still remains about who we are and what is our status within the context of American society. For many of us, the answer is easy. We're not. We're not a part of your, we are separate, just like the Constitution said. I mean, the other two places in the Constitution that were mentioned was in the Treaty Clause, where they say the president has the power to negotiate treaties with foreign nations and with Indians. So we're treated right on par with foreign nations. And the Commerce Clause, where it says Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce in and among several states with foreign nations and with Indian tribes. So we were always mentioned not as a part of the U.S. population and not as a part of the U.S. population under the U.S. Constitution. So what happened let me jump back to the 100 years before this declaration. So what happens in that 100 years? A little over 100 years. Well, in 1823, which is 101 years before they passed this law, the Supreme Court codifies a legal doctrine that was drawn out of the churches and then was accepted by the Christian monarchs of Europe, which and that legal doctrine was called the Doctrine of Christian Discovery, wherein the church basically encouraged the Christian monarchs to go into the world, into lands unknown to the Christian nations of Europe, and take whatever. I mean, look, people call it colonization, but it's not. It's theft. They took people in terms of human beings for and enslaved them. They took their possessions. They took their property. They took their land. They took natural resources. And that all came out of this doctrine of Christian discovery. Now, the church today says, oh, no, we didn't do that. We didn't create this legal doctrine. That's a misinterpretation of papal bulls. Well, we can debate that. But the fact that the Catholic Church is basically saying, no, that's not us, it kind of even weakens the position of, especially of the United States, because almost no country relied on the doctrine of Christian discovery more than the United States, with the possible exception of Canada. So they take this and they take this doctrine and they basically say, look, if you're not Christian, you don't own land. Because only the Christian nations of Europe essentially could own land, and of course their descendants, the United States being a child of England, right? So that's what it said. It basically said that we are like animals. We just live there. We don't own title to land. We may occupy a space, but we don't own the land. And as a result, and this was all done by the Supreme Court. This is not a law that passed that said this. This is all done by the Supreme Court. And they basically said, whatever sovereignty they did have, and we're not even going to try to quantify that, but whatever they had was diminished, evaporated upon discovery. So in other words, the mere idea or the mere act of laying Christian eyes upon us, you know, made our sovereignty diminish. And of course, they also tried to equate discovery with conquest. So they also said the mere act of laying their eyes on us mean that they conquered us. Now, we didn't acknowledge that, but that's what they said. I mean, in the history of the United States, there was probably only 50 tops armed conflicts between Native peoples and the United States. Maybe 50. And the United States didn't win them all either. So when I hear anybody say, and look, I hear it all the time, especially as I get people riled up over this mascot debate, I hear white people say, yeah, well, you were a conquered people. No, we weren't. We were cheated and defrauded. But you know what? In spite of all that, we're still here. So again, so more about that 100 years. So in 1823, the Supreme Court under Chief Justice John Marshall makes the doctrine of Christian discovery part of U.S. law. Then less than a decade later, he hears a case and he adds more legal dicta to this, what would be called the trilogy of cases. In Cherokee versus Georgia, he comes up with this concept that, you know what, Native people, they're not like, they aren't citizens. I mean, he doesn't say that, but he says they're like wards of the state. And so this idea of what we still refer to today as this trust responsibility. So In 1831, the Supreme Court comes up with this idea that the United States is holding us as wards of their federal government and that they have a federal trust responsibility. Of course, it's not like normal trust law. This is different because the first and foremost priority with this trust relationship is the national interest of the United States. The next year, this is 1832, the Supreme Court goes a step further and then suggests that Native people were never really recognized as foreign nations. It doesn't matter what the Constitution says. It never really says that. And in fact, it was always the will of the founding fathers for Congress to have absolute power over Native people. Now, there's no place in the Constitution that says that. There's no law that says that. There's no surrender agreement. There's no annexation treaty, nothing like that. So this is just made up, all three of these things. Doctrine of Discovery being part of U.S. law, this trust responsibility and wards of the state thing, and this plenary powers doctrine of Congress. All this stuff made up by the Supreme Court. That's all within, you know, the first 30, you know, 32 years of the 19th century. So then what? So what does that mean? So who are we? What's our status? Well, as far as the court is concerned, and this hasn't really turned into any specific enacted law yet. Well, we're there. We're just people who happen to live in a place. In the meantime, they're killing us. They're taking our children and putting their putting them into residential schools. This whole thing is just getting started. But we're not U.S. citizens. We have not surrendered ourselves to this. But as far as the white folks are concerned, we're just like animals. We're beneath them. We are uncivilized. We are ignorant, and we are untrustworthy, and that we need to be treated as if we are wards of the federal government. Of course, then they get mired. So, and all this time, they're taking more and more of our lands, right? And they're negotiating certain treaties and stuff like that, but that they have no intention of keeping. But they also get involved in a civil war. After the Civil War, they passed the 14th Amendment, which says that, you know, all the people are within the United States are U.S. citizens, except those that are not under U.S. jurisdiction. So we weren't a part of that. 1865, we weren't a part of that. So we're still not citizens, mind you. That's my point. Even after the 14th Amendment, we're still not citizens. We are not part of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. None of that stuff. We are people who coexist, and we're not even really being called people, on the same lands, and oftentimes lands that the United States has not necessarily been able to forcefully claim yet. That's 1865. So 20 years later, they passed the Dawes Act. And the Dawes Act is all about taking our lands. And in fact, the Dawes Act has a provision in it where they try to make Native people U.S. citizens. But they do it by dissolving any of their claims to being Native. So they have to accept lands that were being taken from them and then given back through an allotment process. And they're encouraged to accept being declared U.S. citizens. And there's not this isn't broad based. This is just very specific to the General Allotment Act of that was involved in the Dawes Act. When the United States acquires Alaska, they have what they call the cession laws. And there again, they try to make the Native people in the Alaska Territory U.S. citizens, and they say, but you can't be Native people. We're denying that you even can refer to yourselves as Native people. You have to accept, you have to reject your identity, and you have to accept this U.S. citizenship. Oh, let me jump back again. I'm sorry. Between this Dawes Act of 1887, or actually even before that, the what was called the Appropriations Act of 1871, this is where Congress does pass a law and says, "Nah, we're not recognizing that any Native people are sovereign, independent nations." So, again, this idea of dual citizenship—no, they put that to bed in 1871. They said no. Congress no longer will recognize, and of course, this is how they did away with this with the treaty clause. They actually took away an executive privilege, which was to negotiate treaties. No, we're not recognizing them as distinct entities anymore. They are wards of the state, not citizens. They are wards of the federal government. That's what they said in 1871. So again, then they do this thing with Alaska, and then in the wake of World War I, they pass what they call a Citizenship Act. And there they are going to reward Native people who enlisted in the U.S. military with citizenship if they want it. Again, if they want it. That's 1819. 5 years later, they pass this law, the Indian Citizenship Act. And that's when they just declare that we're all citizens. Now, none of this is legal. There's no part of, I mean, even the Appropriations Act of 1871, where they declared that Native people were wards of the state. I mean, they kind of did that based on a Supreme Court law that or Supreme Court opinion, not even the ruling. But there's nothing that's legal about it. You can't just make people U.S. citizens. I mean, the rest of the world called that a war crime. They called it denationalization. So that's what happens in the run-up to the ultimate law of the Citizenship Act, which is now essentially 100 years old, you know, this summer. So they did all of this, did all this legislation, they did all this treaty making, they did all these things in the 100 years prior. And then towards the end, about the time that they're really trying to force citizenship upon us, then they try to negate it all. Say, well, no, you're not. We don't need to recognize you as independents. We don't need to recognize you as distinct entities. You know, it raises a question. Then what the hell are we? Well, in 1924, they said we're all U.S. citizens. But again, couldn't vote. Almost couldn't vote anywhere because the states were saying, look, you can make them citizens, but we don't think they warrant the right to vote. And again, we were probably the last people whose right to vote as U.S. citizens was even acknowledged. Now, again, but let me say clearly, we didn't necessarily accept the Citizenship Act. The Haudenosaunee in particular didn't accept it. And many people didn't accept it. But I'm going to tell you, over time, 100 years, most Native people have consented to this thing. In fact, if you ask Native people, well, when did Native people get to be U.S. citizens? They all say 1924. That's when we were made U.S. citizens. Or that's when we were granted U.S. citizenship. The former is more accurate. They tried to force it on us. And so then it leads that question, are we taxable now? I mean, there's a provision in that Citizenship Act that says nothing of our personal or tribal property should be impacted by this. Well, what about the sale of our labor? What about income? What about all this stuff? See, none of that stuff is answered. So instead, once they declare that we're U.S. citizens, then they just try to quietly say that all of their laws apply to us. So taxation, you know, land seizures. Look, we had lots of land that was seized. The Kinzua Dam Project, Pittsburgh had a flooding problem. So they condemned 10,000 acres of Seneca land and they threw a dam up and they flooded out or condemned to a floodplain 10,000 acres of valuable farmland of the Seneca people. And it was illegal as hell. They would come back later and make some payments and try to, you know, solve it with a settlement. But this is what has been the experience. So as I sit here today, I have to say that when we look at things like the poverty that exists on Native territories, it's all driven by this, I mean, people talk about nanny state. I mean, it's all driven by this notion that the United States would claim to have power over us, even when there's no legal claim for it. So I'm going to tell you, I mean, some of you are going to hear this topic brought up from time to time. I've got a few other things that I'm trying to get squared away to talk about. I know somebody asked me specifically about missing and murdered Indigenous women and Indigenous peoples. I just so people know, there were a few laws. There was a law passed when Deb Haaland was still a congresswoman. She and three other Native congresspersons tried to push forward something called the Not Invisible Act. And so it called for the creation of a commission. So that's in, you know, 2020. It took 3 years for that commission to come up with a report, and that report came out last year, and now there's a report that just came out from the Department of Interior and the Department of Justice in response to that report. And I can talk about that in future shows. But I'm going to talk about the Citizenship Act. I'm going to talk about these legal doctrines that were created out of thin air. Because here's the most important thing I've got to say about all that. Anybody who believes that the United States is founded in rule of law and democracy, you're wrong. You're just flat out wrong. And in fact, most countries have as their legal foundation these laws that were never passed through any legislative process. They were not passed by the people. They came down from the monarchs. You know, they came from authoritarian rule. And everything that defines the relationship between Native people and the United States, and the same with Canada for that matter, has been created out of this authoritarian rule. It was not passed. It was not legislated. There were no laws that created these things. But they codified, they embedded it in their law because a white man in a black robe said so. He said the doctrine of Christian discovery should be the law of the land. He said that Native people should be treated as wards of the state and the United States should be viewed as the trustee for Native people. He said that Congress had absolute power to regulate the meets and bounds of Native sovereignty and actually rule in all matters relating to Native people. And in fact, if you challenge a law based on whether it's constitutional or not, that a law impacting Native people, the Indian Child Welfare Act, this poor white family from Texas, no, this rich white family from Texas, was trying to challenge that law. And they said they were discriminated against because they couldn't adopt a Native child. In fact, they couldn't adopt two Native children. And they said they were being discriminated against, that it was racist, and that it violated the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protections Clause. It said that Native people were being granted special privileges simply by virtue of their race. Now, the Supreme Court never addressed those issues. You know what the Supreme Court said? They said, none of that matters because Congress has the power to do whatever they want with Native people. It doesn't matter if it's not constitutional. It doesn't matter if the law is racist. We're not saying that it is, but even if it was, if Congress has absolute authority to create laws governing and controlling and impacting Native people. That's what the Supreme Court said. They said it in McGirt in Oklahoma. They said it in Indian Child Welfare Act. They said it when they created the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Every law that has been passed since the early 1800s has been based on this belief, because the Supreme Court said so, that Congress has ultimate power, ultimate authority over Native peoples. What a sham. What a sham. All right, folks. Hey, we're at the bottom of the hour. I'm going to go to take some phone calls now. So first off, let me remind people that we are listener-supported radio. I need you to support WBAI and WPFW. I need you to become a sustaining member of these stations, or as we say in New York, a BAI buddy. So I need you to go to the phone lines first, not to call in here, but, well, you know, if you make a mistake and you call the pledge line first, you know, while you're there, make a donation. 212-209-2950. That's the number to call to make a donation in New York City. Or you can go online to give2wbai.org. If you want to donate to WPFW, if you're in Washington, or if this is a place that you want to support that station, another fine station, I ask you to call 202-588-9739 or go online to wpfwfm.org/donate. Please support these stations, support my spot, my real estate on these stations. And I'll keep doing what I'm doing here. All right. So here is the number to call it. If you want to join in a conversation, look, you are free to talk about what I've presented today, but I'm not going to hold you to it. You can ask me anything you want. But I will say, first off, turn your radio down or off when you make the call. Do not use a speakerphone because it may sound better to you, but it doesn't sound better to us. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, take a breath. I realize that, you know, if you're calling into a radio show, you may not be used to doing it, but give yourself a breath because there may come a time that I may have to interject something in the middle of what you're saying. And if you don't take a breath, if you just ramble on from one subject to another without giving me a chance to respond, I'm probably going to shut you right down. Like I did to a caller last week, because we have to have this is a dialogue. This isn't me giving the show to you. It's me giving you an opportunity to have a dialogue. So again, here's the number, 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Look, you've called into other radio shows. I mean, if you're listening in New York, you've been a participant in probably other shows besides this one. I realize that my show is different, and my show You know, I'm not asking you for questions about how to heal you, and I'm not asking you, you know, necessarily political questions. But I'm saying, look, if you have a question, if you have a comment, if you have something you want to discuss, even again, I'm coming down to the New York area, coming down to Mount Vernon, down in just near Yonkers to speak at an event associated with what's happening between Israel and Gaza, and really to put it in the context of colonialism, or as I prefer to call it, theft, that has been taking place by the nations of Europe for hundreds and hundreds of years. So, Reggie, I don't know if we've got somebody on the line. Go ahead and let me know that. If not, I'll keep going.
I'll let you know.
Okay. Hey, you know, one of the things I wanted to mention as I've talked about this Indian Citizenship Act, in the wake of 9/11, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, they came up with this thing called the Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. I call it Whitey. And what Whitey was is this new way of trying to create travel documents. And so what Whitey did was offered to allow Native people to recreate their tribal IDs, and they call it the Enhanced Tribal Card. And you know what the first question is when you try to apply to get an Enhanced Tribal Card? What is your citizenship? And they ain't talking whether you're Seneca or Mohawk. They mean, because look, there are some Native people who, you know, like even here in Seneca territory, that may have been born on the Canadian side. So you got to first declare whether you're a U.S. or Canadian citizen. The first line on the application for a Whitey enhanced tribal card is what is your citizenship? And then when you get the card, it might say Seneca Nation on it, but right up in the corner, it's got either a U.S. or a Canadian flag on it. And of course, they have other requirements. They want your picture to be done with just the right camera so they can plug your face into their facial recognition technology and their data center. They want a scannable strip. They want an RFID chip in it so they can actually track your movement. Yes, they can actually track. You don't even, when you go through the border with one of these cards, allegedly, Canada doesn't really accept it the same way the United States does. You just have to lift the card out. You don't have to give it to anybody. It'll read it just driving by their little detection post there. So it's been a major flop. But the whole idea that Homeland Security's Whitey organization went ahead and created these enhanced tribal cards is just another example of just what a debacle this whole thing is with U.S. citizenship. So anyway, did you know about Whitey?
So it's actually spelled out as Whitey.
Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. So they missed an I, but yeah, why not put it in there? They actually tried to call it Whitty, but I'm thinking, why call it Whitty? Like, I mean, it's Whitey. So, yeah. So if you didn't know what Whitey was, you know what Whitey is now. You can't make this stuff up. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they really do this stuff. Yeah. Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative. I mean, you know, this is when they kind of upgraded all of their passports. And, of course, the United States still won't let us create our own travel documents. As far as they're concerned, they will prohibit us from leaving this country without getting a U.S. or a Canadian passport. And that's one of the things, again, just absolute craziness. I mean, and most people won't even acknowledge this. You know what I'm saying? It's just crazy. It's just crazy. I don't know. All right, so let me give the number out one more time. It is okay. Let me get my glasses on. I should write this number bigger so I don't have to put my glasses on each time. 212-209-2877. That's the number to call to be a part of the show. To you know, maybe ask a question.
Okay, we got offer a comment.
All right, we'll go right to that caller. Caller, what's your name? And I'm only asking your first name. I'm not gonna stalk you or anything. What's your name and where are you calling from? You're breaking up. Try it again.
Yeah, my name's Joseph. I'm calling to actually driving upstate.
Hey, Joseph. Thanks for calling.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay, great. Appreciate it. Big fan. Been following you since before the pandemic. I'm a teacher in Holland High School. And, I've been trying to decolonize the mindset of my colleagues, but just a general mentality of you know, like a lot of things that you say, they don't even realize that there is a population of indigenous, you know, native people in the United States that still exist.
Right.
there's another topic too. Sometimes I'm a social studies teacher, so we have to grade the reasoning exams. And I actually was going to send you the last year's June regents. It was about the Dawes Act, the organization, Indian Act, all the different acts that the U.S. government did with indigenous people. And again, it's that assumption that they don't have the sovereignty. You know, it's just that the general idea that there's a lack of understanding that, you know, the general population thinks that, oh, no, they're just American citizens and everything's hunky-dory now.
Well, and it's really that they assume they have the authority to do whatever they want to do. And bottom line is, and they don't have any foundation in law for that. So, I mean, one of the things that one of the worst laws was actually the Homestead Act, and that was signed into law by Abraham Lincoln. It resulted in major conflicts, contributed to what they call the Sioux Wars and some of that stuff. And, you know, and in the end, Lincoln signs the execution order for 38 Dakota to be hung by the neck because of their
right.
resistance to this Homestead Act. So, yeah, and see, and here's the thing.
They don't dare mention that in the test, the regents or something, you know. Maybe that's too touchy.
Yeah, I wonder if somebody ever wrote it. On the regents, do they still have essay questions for part of the history regents?
Yeah, no, that was part of it. These were documents. They were document-based questions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, you have to write a short essay response to it. I happen to have some background. I did my student teaching out in Navajo Res, lived out in Window Rock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, met some people out there. I still keep in touch with them. Grew up in the Syracuse area. You know, familiar, you know, had minor in Native American studies at Mansfield University. I know a few folks, a guy named Adrian John from Allegheny Territory.
Yeah, he's out this way, yep, you know, yep.
So I'm familiar with them. Yeah, familiar with the subject. Been dying to call in. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you participating, and I appreciate you attempting. I know it's difficult because of the guidelines, the curriculum guidelines, but... you know, I know that you do guys have, any teacher has a certain amount of flexibility until they're called out for it. So, I mean, any opportunity you have to teach some truth, you know, I greatly appreciate it. And, you know, and I know the students in the long run will be better for having learned some of this stuff. So, so again, Joe, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Reg, do we have any other callers on the line?
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Anybody else on the line, Reg?
Not yet.
All right.
Not
let me
yet.
Let me give the number out one more time. It's, it is 212-209-2877. That's the number to call to, basically have a conversation. And look, I'm going to keep doing a lot of these conversations because I know that this show is in New York and it's in Washington, and I'm not necessarily hitting a predominantly a Native audience. But you know what? I think non-Native people need to know this stuff because just like Joseph was saying, you're not being taught this stuff in school. I mean, you're being...
We got another one.
Okay. What happens is, you know, we see that more people are taught false narratives, and sometimes associated with these Native mascots and everything else. Most people have no idea. I mean, I just recently saw somebody said, "Well, we used to call ourselves the Chiefs. There's nothing wrong with being called a chief. That's a symbol of strength and power." And no, not in our culture. In our culture, a chief is not a symbol of strength and power. They are a symbol. They are a people whose aptitude is to gather the people, not to be strong and powerful. They aren't fighters. They aren't there's a misconception about even what a so-called chief is. Just like this notion of schools calling themselves warriors or raiders or any of these other things that they've associated with Native people. That's the false narrative. That's what's being taught still today in schools. They're taught that our period of history ended with discovery. All right, caller, you're up next. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hi. David from New Jersey. I'm in the grocery line, so I just want to ask a question. Get off. A wonderful show as always. Question, I was drafted for the Army. I didn't have to go back on the Navy later. But back to your case, the are there any Supreme Court cases like they have with Korematsu, who was a Japanese-American interned? He didn't want to go into the war. And also the code talkers. I'm just putting those out there. I don't know anything about it. You know, get up and listen. So a wonderful show.
Well, you know, there we resist this whole notion of registering for the draft because there's obviously, even today, there's a requirement for men, boys who are 18 years old to register for the draft. I missed that window. They started this for anybody who was born in 1960 and later. I was born in 1959, December 1959. So I couldn't even make this fight. But my kids, my son didn't register. I mean, and we've encouraged kids not to do this. And we're going to back them up in the fight. And look, there is no effort to try to challenge us on this thing. But I'm glad you mentioned code talkers, because that's another one of these things that we get heroized for, this notion that we help win the war with our language. And it wasn't just Navajo, it was Choctaw, it was Mohawk, it was a bunch of different people. But many of those people were forced into the military, not just through draft registration, but oftentimes if they could find a reason to arrest a Native person, they would give them a choice. Well, you're either going to serve in the military or you're going to go to jail. And then when they developed this idea of using our language for their codes, and especially using various Native languages, that never made the United States feel committed to preserving our language, because frankly, the fewer people that spoke it, the more secure their codes were. And we were unique in that in terms of being an enlisted man in the military. If you were a code talker, there was actually an order, a standing order from somebody who was assigned to you to kill you rather than let you be captured. Because they thought the code was so important that they would have friendly fire take your life rather than allow you to be captured. That's, you know, that's kind of a unique position in the military to have. So that's my answer to that question. Let me give the number one more time. I don't know if we got another caller yet, but the number is 212.
Yes, we do.
209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. We'll try to get as many in as we can here. All right, caller, you're up next. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Daryl McPherson, Bronx, New York.
Hey, Daryl, thanks for calling in. I greatly appreciate it.
First thing, address the audience. Audience needs $700 for this program. If you don't have capital, go to goodshop.com and shop through that app, or go to goodsearch.org and search, putting WBAI in as your cause of choice. I mean, maybe it would do PFW, but I'm not sure. Now, a couple weeks ago, there was a question about the Civil War. And what I'd like you to do is I got a little pieces of this. The last general of the Civil War to surrender, I believe, that means I don't know, is a Cherokee, person. And the other piece is that my understanding is that the way you got to Black Wall Street is that all the enslaved people that the Cherokees had that were associated with the Confederacy, they had to give land to the people who they freed as part of the Treaty of Surrender. And if I get a chance, because I'm having some challenges here, as you can tell, I'll send you some information. But that's an interesting thing in the context of the way Wall Street was rebuilt, was through the land that was obtained from the Cherokees by the enslaved people, who then did they get totally thrown out of the nation, off the rolls?
Well, let me address that. First off, I'm not familiar with a Cherokee general being the last Confederate general to surrender. So that I'd have to look that one up. I don't know that. But I will say is that the Cherokee were cheated of their land and were moved out to Oklahoma. And
definitely,
some of the Cherokee, that's considered the Trail of Tears. And some of the Cherokee were slave owners, and they did free their slaves. Now, this wasn't about the Cherokee surrendering to the United States, but there was a lot of pressure put on by the United States, and in an effort to resolve this this class of people that the Cherokee did allow them to be part of their enrollment, and they actually called them freedmen. And but yes, there were land grants that were given that were a part of establishing what was called Black Wall Street. Now, Black Wall Street was Tulsa was a suburb essentially, or a section of Tulsa, and Black Wall Street is what was destroyed in 1923, or I think it was 1923, with the Tulsa riots. So it wasn't Wall Street, New York; it was Wall Street in Tulsa, and this was a massive massacre by white people killing black people in what was had become a pretty thriving community of black people. But I will say there were several towns throughout Oklahoma that were created, all black communities created out of native lands. And some of that is a little unclear on how much of this was direct negotiation between the formerly enslaved, not just enslaved by native people, but formerly enslaved that were pushed out west, you know, during Reconstruction and that kind of stuff. But there was there were all black communities that did get carved out of the Oklahoma landscape, which was supposed to be essentially all native territories. And frankly, some of that is a little unclear. I think a lot of it was pushed upon the native people, and there were various nations that lived in Oklahoma to provide land for these black communities. And you know, of course, there was also this idea of land grants where everything from the railroad to colleges were given native land that they could sell to create their own endowments and their own investment funds for some of this stuff. I know that doesn't answer your questions exactly, but that's what I know about.
Actually,
go ahead.
Actually, John, that's what I'm pointing to. It would be interesting to know what was the relationship between the freedmen and the nations. And
it wasn't always terrible, but I will say that has become an issue even as of late. There were recent, you know, suits, lawsuits and stuff like that by black Cherokees, the freedmen, that were trying to fight for some of their rights as Cherokee. And of course that gets complicated because who hears that case? But and there's no question that there was a lot of, for lack of a better word, race mixing between native people and black people in everything from the Seminoles in Florida to the slave trade that happened between Long Island and the Caribbean. Many of the slaves that ran away in the Deep South, like in the Choctaw and the Tuscarora, there were a lot of native people who had welcomed in, black people escaping slavery. And so but it's not really as smooth as what people think. I mean, everybody's familiar with Bob Marley's song, Buffalo Soldier, but they don't realize, but his song is sarcastic. And he's talking about the fact that these black men were being paid to hunt down native people. And so that tension doesn't go away simply after the Civil War. And so it's a complicated relationship, but it wasn't always bad and it wasn't always good. All right, that just about wraps it up. I want to thank you, Daryl, thanks for calling and asking about those things. I'm going to do some more programs on some of this.
Can we continue that discussion? Because this is all around the Galveston thing, in which the African troops were there to then invade Mexico, basically, and quote-unquote quell. And when you talk about the Cherokee, what nation of indigenous people tried to meld into the revolutionary, the new country, more than the Cherokee, and look what they got for it.
Well, and look, they had very much assimilated, and then they were forced on the march in the Trail of Tears to go to Oklahoma, and there they basically had a different disposition after that. But no, and I will have further conversations on this, but I appreciate the call. I know we're just about out of time, so I hate to cut you off, but this is my time slot coming to an end. I want to thank you for listening. I want to remind people that we are listener-supported radio, and I implore you to support WPFW in Washington, D.C., and WBAI in New York City. Help these stations survive. Help my time slot survive these stations as well. And look, I'll plan to be back here next week. I'm John Kane, and this is Resistance Radio. Yahweh.